the 95% and in the 10%.
So they're going to the private sector then?
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 19th, 2007. Let the record reflect a quorum is present. And we had to delay the start of the hearing because of the long floor session. Also, then, Care 11 pulled me aside. They want to do a presidential trivia quiz on me. They already, and I did quite well, as a matter of fact. So, and then they asked me if I wanted to ask, the reporter said, well, would you want to ask me a question? I said, sure. Who was the first president who had a bathtub in the White House?
Chester Arthur.
Millard Fillmore.
Millard Fillmore.
There wasn't a lot that happened during Fillmore's watch, but that was one.
Zachary Taylor.
Geez, Mr. Chair, and I thought I was doing good to know the first president that made it a habit to throw out the first baseball of the season.
That would have been, who was that then?
Taft,
yeah, okay. Okay. Anyway, well,
here's your presidential trivia for the day.
Yeah.
We'll be having a test later, number from 1 to 10.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we have the Department of Revenue and that we, in our budget books. That's towards the beginning.
It's in the middle.
Okay. And I just saw the commissioner upstairs. He's on his way to a meeting with the governor. He'll join us a little later. Who do we have? Commissioner Salmoni, are you? Okay. Looks like you've got a presentation here for us. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Salamone. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. It's my pleasure to be here on a holiday Monday.
Yeah.
So is ours. We're happy to be here, too.
You should have a set of slides with the title page, Senate Budget Division. My goal here is to walk you through the slides, answer any questions you have about the department budget. My disclaimer is I'm still sort of in a training mode as Deputy Commissioner, so undoubtedly there will be questions that I won't be able to answer. And I have my A-team here sitting on the sidelines who, if I don't have the answer, one of them will likely have it. Our goal is to give you all the information you need to understand our budget and to understand the change items that the governor is proposing. Our mission on the first page you see is to make the revenue system work well for Minnesota. That's a very short sentence, but you wouldn't believe how much time we took in retreat to come up with that one sentence, to make sure every word had meaning. And this is part of our strategic plan that drives everything that we do in the revenue department. I think the nicest view globally of what we do in the department is shown by the circular diagram, which not only provides a nice description of the various functions that we provide, but it also provides a picture of the interconnectedness of those functions. So you can start with that circular diagram anywhere you want. I tend to view the information part as probably the beginning. We take it as a responsibility to provide taxpayers about their obligations and rights in terms of their tax obligation to the state of Minnesota. And there's a long list of things we do in the category of inform, writing forms and instructions, media relations. We do publications, research publications that inform policy making up here. Two notable ones are a tax incident study, which is coming up here on March 1st. That tells you the overall progressivity of the tax system. We do a study called the tax expenditure study, which is not due again until a year from March, but that's a catalog of all the exemptions that are currently in the tax system. And that's a very valuable tool. We serve the taxpayers in many ways by providing them information, providing them good options for meeting their tax obligations. One of the biggest circles here, one of the biggest functions here, and this diagram doesn't show the relative magnitudes, but processing of tax returns is by far the biggest portion of the Department of Revenue, processing returns and payments. So that processing function is very critical. It also is a point at which we capture a lot of data about taxpayers through that system. We do early audits while the return is being processed to flag any obvious compliance issues. What we don't catch in that process moves on to the audit function, where we have a very robust audit program, which, as you know, has been supplemented over the previous few years with tax compliance initiatives. If we don't get a reasonable response from taxpayers to the audit we then move on to a higher level of presence with our enforcement activities. This could be culminates ultimately in litigation if we don't get the satisfaction from the taxpayer. Then there's a recommendation function. We take it as our responsibility as a department to inform the legislature of necessary law changes, both in the short term and in the long term. We feel that we have the expertise and the viewpoint, I guess, to bring to the table important information as it relates to new laws that we feel are needed. So that is a good description of the cycle of life, if you will, of the Department of Revenue. And you'll notice in small print there are some revenue numbers on the bottom of the chart and at the top that indicate the dollar amounts associated with the cycle and in the case of the bottom two, the audit and enforcement. Those figures are for fiscal year 06. In terms of what we do, there's a zillion statistics we can throw at you here, but try to give you some of the ones we feel are sort of impressive. We handle 3.5 million individual income taxpayers. We process about 2.5 million returns, but in terms of people, it's 3.5 million. 165,000 withholding taxpayers. We pay property tax refund claimants, 625,000 of those a year. 8,000 professional tax preparers depend on communications from us and interaction with us. 250,000 businesses collect and remit sales tax. 200,000 corporations, that should read C corporations, S corporations, partnerships, pay the corporate franchise tax and income taxes to the department. I won't go over every number, but you gives you a sense of the volume that we deal with in terms of forms and payments and so on. We also interact with 3,200 local units of government, primarily through our property tax division, which is relatively small in the big scheme of things in the department, but very critical to the payment of state aids to local governments, resolution of all kinds of issues, including the valuation of property. So that's a very important piece. We collect annually about $17 billion in revenue. As I mentioned, we provide forms and instructions. Here's a statistic, 4 million taxpayers in total. We process over 5 million filing and payment transactions. We process and pay 96% of all of our tax refunds within 5 days. And it's a remarkable, I think, performance statistic. It's even shorter than that in the very early stages of filing. So the very early filers might get their refund in 2 days, particularly if they give us a routing number for their checking or savings account. We answer 500,000 phone calls a year, 90,000 audits, and assess over $300 million, collect over $200 million in delinquent taxes. I will continue, Mr. Chair, just moving ahead unless there are questions.
As long as we're on the filing part, maybe we can ask, you know, just delve into that. Are we saving any money? Is it what's the net result of having more e-filers? I know more people are doing it, but
we're certainly saving money by e-filing. E-filing has allowed us to transition employees from lower valued activities, handling paper, manually checking things and so on, to we were able over time, and I have a slide coming up on this, to recycle, if you will, those employees into higher value activities in the Department of Revenue. So we're getting more efficiencies, we're getting better performance in terms of how fast we get payments and refunds processed. So the answer is yes, we are saving money. Of course, when we are in that situation, we're able to redeploy those employees in the compliance area of the department where there's a high payoff to that activity. So there's a slide coming where we talk about the shift in the department internally from what was support activity to more direct compliance activity, both as a result of e-filing but also as a result of the legislative priorities that we've had over the last few years.
I'm guessing later on we're going to talk about the technology that you're going to need in order to keep track of the
Absolutely.
Electronic, and is that the other side of the equation that's going to take us more money to, you know, try to keep up with all that?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. One of our top priorities, the top priority of the Department of Revenue is to modernize our technology. We have a lot of information coming up on that.
If there aren't any other questions, then finally go on. Please continue.
I was just mentioning the shift in the department over the years. The makeup of the department has changed due to four factors that we've flagged. One is the transformation, as I mentioned, from paper processes to cost-saving electronic transactions. I have a sheet that's not part of your slides that document the shift from paper to electronic, and if you're interested, I'll be happy to distribute these. It's not part of the presentation, but we've documented very well the shift. Secondly, there's been the creation of web-based services has replaced higher-cost mail and telephone-based services. Taxpayers are beginning to get a lot of what they want through the Internet, and this is one big area we hope to expand dramatically with an introduction of new technology that is being recommended by the governor. A third shift is increased funding for stepped-up tax compliance initiatives that we've experienced over the last several years. When we get tax compliance funding, we direct most of those funds to the direct compliance activities and not very much, if any, to the support functions. And finally, permanent budget cuts in 2003 has led to a shift from support to compliance. You recall back in the 2003 year, we were making significant cuts in agency budgets, I think of the average of 15%. And in revenue, we basically put a 15% reduction on the support side of the house to contribute to the correction of the budget deficit. So those factors count for a significant shift. The next slide shows how we define direct compliance and compliance support in terms of operating divisions in the revenue department. So if you're wondering about how we're using these terms, you'll see the income tax, corporate, property, petroleum, special, withholding, collection enforcement, and criminal investigations we put into that direct compliance category. There's no scientific way to do this, but it's a judgment call on our part. Compliance support, our return and payment processing, that's a very big part of the department. Technology, tax forms and information services, financial reporting and reconciliation, tax research, and so on. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you there wasn't some relation between these two columns. I mean, if you know, these are interrelated. Without the support functions, you begin to have problems with compliance. But in terms of closeness to the actual auditing and enforcement, I think that's the first column, and support is there, HR and so on, to make it all happen. Here's the shift I'm referring to. In 2000-2001 biennium, 52% of our department's resources were in compliance support, 48% were in direct compliance, as I defined those terms in the previous slide. In the 06-07 biennium, that had changed to 35% support and 65% direct compliance. Now, I don't know what that proportion should be, but it's just a fact that it has been changing over time as we have focused more and more on direct compliance activity. Number one, that's where the big dollar payoff is. And the question I think that's unresolved in my mind is, at what point do you, if you continue to ratchet down the support activity, at what point do you begin to see a revenue impact in terms of collections? And I don't have the answer for that. It's one of the things that we worry about.
Well, and the reverse, though, is that you're never going to get 100% compliance. It would be nice, but we're not going to get that. So at what point do you hit the diminishing returns that you can hire more and more people for compliance, and at some point it's not going to make that much of a difference?
I agree, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any explanation as to why it's gone from the compliance has changed from the 2001 biennium to 2006? Anything? What caused those numbers to shift?
Mr. Chair, that was a slide slides back,
okay,
where I talked about
it was a paper to electronic and so on.
Had those things not happened, I can't tell you what those proportions would be today, but I suspect they might still be less than 52 because the whole culture of the department is shifting toward more compliance mentality, which is really what we're all about. But, of course, you can't get compliance if you don't have the service functions and the informational functions and so on.
Sir Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, I had a question regarding when one does this type of projection. Well, actually, we're not doing projections here, but when the state creates its projections on surplus or deficits in our budget, do we take into account that type of a ratio of compliance and non-compliance when we do that, or is it simply a rougher, more general number?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it's not directly related to these shares. The Finance Department looks at the history of revenue collections, actual revenue collections. So they have a lot of history, and they'll basically forecast off of that. The only exception would be if we, as we had in the past, when we get compliance initiatives, they will recognize that usually in the forecast. So it's based on a longer history of trends in revenues and judgments made about the future of those revenue sources, not directly the ratios here that we're talking about.
So, Mr. Chair, if let's say the state was anticipating a smaller $1 billion deficit, could one make that up just on compliance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I would say no. That's a large number if you're talking about a billion-dollar catch-up through compliance. I would note that the compliance, what we call the tax gap, which is the amount that we think is theoretically owed to the state, in the income tax and in the sales tax, total about $1 billion, a little over $1 billion. And we're very careful, I've said to this committee and others, that that's a theoretical number. It's not based on looking at tax returns. It's based on looking at census data about the economy and our tax laws to try to infer what would we expect to get if everyone were 100% compliant, which is not realistic by a long shot. So our best strategy is to work the compliance side of the house to get as much of that money as we can, recognizing we're never going to get all of it.
Go ahead.
The next slide shows the history of our complement in terms of number of FTEs. And you'll see a decline from the years 96 on this chart to 2002. That is reflective, I suspect, of, first of all, in the early years, the shift from paper to electronic filing. It is also a reflection in the later years of budget difficulties. And then starting in 2002 and on, we have compliance initiative revenues coming from the legislature. We've had three. The governor is proposing a fourth one in the current budget. And so we've added employees as a result of getting compliance initiative money. But even with that compliance initiative money, if you look at 2006, you'll see our FTE is no different than it was in 1998. I'm not suggesting that that's a problem. It's just if you look at the 1,225, it puts it into context there. There's a lot of history here. I'll talk about the governor's proposed compliance initiative later in the slide presentation, and we'll talk about additional FTE associated with that. What I want to do now is talk about the major challenges we see in the Department of Revenue, both in the short term and in the long term. And we obsess about a lot of this. We have a lot of meetings and strategic planning and SWOT analysis and so on to try to figure out what our major issues are. And we've flagged seven major challenges. The first is our aging and fragmented computer systems, and that's plural. We have many systems. I'll show you a striking picture of that later in the presentation. We need to advance our technology in the Revenue Department. Secondly, our aging workforce. We're an old department, and we're going to be losing a lot of talent in the next 3 to 5 years, leadership talent. Third, and we've talked about this last time we were in this committee, we face steep competition for our accountants. There's a high degree of turnover in our newly hired accountants. They tend to leave us right after they are fully trained, but before they are fully effective. So that's a real problem for us. Another challenge we haven't talked a lot about is the growing diversity of the population. The numbers of non-English-speaking taxpayers has risen dramatically and will continue to rise dramatically in future years. That's a real challenge for us. We have, you know, our history has been to provide forms and instructions in English, and only recently have we realized the need to now translate many of those materials, certainly into Spanish, into the Hmong language and other languages that are going to be increasingly challenging for us. And it's not just the forms and instructions, it's telephone service. You need to be able to talk to these folks on telephone and understand, give them a chance to be understood. So we have to think about strategies to serve a more diverse population. Some of these people have no context for paying taxes from their home cultures. Any association with the government may actually be viewed as a negative from their history. So it's a real challenge for us. The next three are sort of longer term in my view, and we really haven't prioritized these, I should say, except for the first one, which we do flag as our number one priority. The next one is changes in the economy. The economy is certainly changing, and the main issues here are the effect of electronic commerce shift in population, the aging of the population, so that kind of overlaps with the second one. Another long-term issue is the growing complexity of tax laws. Tax systems, if left alone, will tend to sort of erode over time as more provisions are added year after year. If you look at our history in Minnesota, every so many years, maybe it's 5 or 10 years, we'll have a major reform, and often it will simplify the tax system, sort of recalibrate it, and then it starts to get more complex again over time. It doesn't happen automatically. It's just a result of a collection of activities up here and at the federal level that sometimes make things very complicated for us. And finally, our challenge, of course, that last one, improving compliance with the tax laws. We know we have to get a better rate of compliance, and we've gotten help from the legislature to do that, and it's an ongoing issue for us. Now, I'm going to run through a bunch of slides real quick, a little more detail on each of these.
Sure. Just before, yeah, and I think the computers, you know, if they're aging, you know, you get new computers. Will you be talking about the aging workforce and what we may need to do to try to make a transition to not lose everybody at once there? Is that coming up?
Okay. Yes, okay. That is. And okay. Mr. Chair, I might add that we do have this new post-retirement option that the legislature has provided the agencies, where once an employee is retired, they can come back on for a period of time and get health benefits and so on. It's tremendously valuable to the agencies. That has been to us in revenue. First, a little more on the aging computer systems. We currently have 143 computer applications operating on 11 different platforms. Platform would be like Windows or AIX. So for 28 different tax types. So depending on the tax type you're working, sales, income, withholding, you may have a whole different set of computer systems, plural, to work with. When a taxpayer calls the Revenue Department for information about their own situation or their own account, often our person on the telephone has to go to 3 or 4 or 5 different computer systems to get an answer. And it's very non-optimal, to say the least, in terms of taxpayer assistance. The systems we have now, by and large, are costing us more to support and maintain. We have multiple technologies and multiple platforms, development languages, so it's getting more costly. We have a number of aging systems that will have to be replaced in the next 5 years. And that's a really important point because we are asking the legislature, the governor's asking the legislature for money for a new computer system. We're going to spend a significant amount of money just updating what we already have, and we'll get very little or nothing for it. So it's really important to note that we're going to have to spend money no matter what. And our concern is the risk of failure and disruption in the current systems. Without better technology, we simply can't respond to taxpayer expectations for enhanced services and better information. I can go to my bank website, and I can do just about anything there. I can get into debt real easily, in fact, on the website. But I can move money from one account to another. I can check on the status of a payment and on. Very little of that can a taxpayer do right now with the Department of Revenue. It's all very manual and piecemeal. So a new system would give us a shot at a much better and higher level of enhanced services to taxpayers. We also have an inability to provide employees and taxpayers with easy access. Our people need to have access to data, correct data, about taxpayers from a single source, not 20 or 30. or as I said earlier, maybe four or five in terms of inquiries. Our employees, when they move from one tax division to another under the current system or systems, they often have to be retrained. Even though they're still processing, doing the same sort of functions for each tax, or the old tax and the new tax, they need to go through training to get up to speed on the systems particular to that new tax type. I mentioned the growing risk of failure and disruption. It would be awful if we couldn't get tax payments processed and if we couldn't get tax returns out. And there are a couple systems in our whole web of systems that are critical. They're core to getting those tax payments processed and refunds out to taxpayers. For example, our taxpayer account system is central to the whole thing, and it's kind of fragile. We lack systems for information analytical tools for effectively improving tax compliance. We were in here earlier talking about the legislative auditor's report about the revenue department. And one of the raps we got, and I think it was an accurate report, we do not have quality information to make good management decisions or to provide improved compliance. We're behind the ball on this stuff. So I think the better, more unified computer system would advance the goal of being better informed about our own department in terms of knowing where do you get the highest return on the next auditor, for example. We need good data to be able to make those decisions. I mentioned I'd give you a visual about the situation we have right now. I can't think of a better visual than this. I hope it's legible on the screen. If you look across the columns, you have different tax types: income, sales, withholding, corporate, partnership, and so on. But down the side, you have functions identifying the taxpayer, information about the taxpayer, social security number, their status, and so on. The filing and paying functions, the compliance function, and the collection function are the standard things that we do in the department. Everywhere where you see multiple colors, those are multiple systems. They're different systems. So if you're in the income tax division, you go down that column and you'll see all the different systems you have to deal with. What's notable here is that there are only three rows where the color is the same all the way across. So we take that gray row about four or five down. That's check processing. No matter what division in the department you work for, you're using the same system to cut a check. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, you don't have to be relearning things from one tax to another. Then you drop down. The only other areas on the chart where there's commonality of software and systems is in the collections area of the department, and we should be thankful for that. We can do a decent job of collecting taxes that are owed because we have common software. Our goal is to have all of these rows be the same color when we get our integrated tax system. That's essentially what the governor is proposing, that we get out from under this hodgepodge of systems that are very fragile. I'm told the oldest of these systems was put in 1968. And it's time to sort of get up to modern technology here.
Well, and let me just pause for a second here. And as I understand the governor's proposal and the department's, you're looking at some off-the-shelf technology which may have its advantages. I don't know how this works on a statewide level because, I mean, does every state – is there a program out there for, you know, a state? And, you know, if there is, how many states are going to buy it? But do we take a risk if we buy some off-the-shelf program that it's going to be outdated or, you know, not serviced in a few years, and we spend a lot of money for programs that we're going to have to redo and so forth? This field changes too much for some of us, but we're talking about major decisions here, and we got to make sure we make the right one. How do we know that if we spend a lot of money to update these decisions, as we should, you know, we're making the right ones? What's going to guide us?
Mr. Chair, I think what gives us a degree of comfort on this is that there is a relatively new and fast-growing industry of firms that are providing integrated tax systems to the states. And I'll have a slide coming up showing the number of states that have already moved in this direction. And with that market being strong, it's our expectation that if we are able to buy an off-the-shelf package, number one, we will customize our internal processes to fit the software. It's our expectation that the software vendors will have sufficient motivation to make adjustments in the software on a year-to-year basis. So in a sense, a lot of our work that we would have to do in-house in terms of development will be done by these the software vendors, who will have sufficient competition to give us a competitive price on the upgrade of this software from year to year. In fact, I would guess that the development money that we are currently spending is greater than what we would spend on annual updates of this software. But I would defer to our technical person who's here to, he's nodding yes, so I assume that that's an accurate statement. So, in a sense, we're better off than we would be if we stay with a checkerboard system here, where we have to internally find funds to upgrade these systems, patch them up, and they're so complicated now. If you have some little patch on one software, you've got to manually find out how it affects all these other systems. And we would get rid of a lot of that with an integrated system.
What kind of system do you have that goes back to 1968, though?
Some code that was built in programming language.
Why don't you come to the mic so we can catch it on. These things are taped, and you'll need to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Greg Cheeta. I am working in the CIO office at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Okay.
We've always done the best that we could with the money that we had, and some of our old mainframe systems, as I said, there's some programming language that's actually called Mantis. It's the programming language back then that's still sitting out there and running some code, hooked back into the systems. I believe it's with the accounting system back in that area. So we've also got some very new systems, too, and that's one of the problems that we had. One other thing I'd like to mention that Dan talked about is right now, because it's such a hodgepodge of systems, every time we do make a change, we have to make sure we didn't break something. We have 120 people listed in our testing unit, so that when we make a change, they can go in and test to see if we've broken things or not. Now, they don't test full-time all the rest of the time, but even if they only spend 10% of their time testing, we have basically 12 employees on a year-round basis who all they do are, or FTE, I guess I would say, that do the testing to make sure that all this stuff doesn't break. The new systems would get rid of a lot of that issue. You still have to test, but nowhere near the same magnitude it is right now.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Commissioner, go ahead.
The next challenge is switching off of, I'll have more information later in the slide presentation on the governor's proposal for a new system. Let me move to challenge number two, in the aging workforce. In the next 5 years, we estimate that we're going to lose about 250 employees. That's one out of every five through retirement. So we are working hard at workforce planning. And this is not a revenue department issue. This is a state issue. I think every agency is struggling with this. I do think we're one of the older agencies in terms of the age distribution. So every one of our divisions has a mandate to do workforce planning. And at some point, we need to check back and say, okay, who's going to replace Joe? Got to get very specific about people who are getting close to retirement, who have a lot of experience and institutional knowledge. There has to be someone ready to take that position. We're replacing, when they leave, we have to replace their collective experience and knowledge about the taxes they're working with. I had an experience my first year in revenue as commissioner when one of our most experienced property tax people walked into my office, and I saw him standing in the door and he says, "I'm here to say goodbye. This is my last day." Well, there was no time to have an offload of all the knowledge he had and the data and so on. We were scrambling for a long time after he left. So we have to manage these systems a little bit better. When we lose experienced employees, of course, we also run the risk of losing revenue. Experienced people are more productive, particularly in the audit area. So we are working hard to make sure we bring in good people to replace them and keep them. Keeping them is our biggest challenge.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Commissioner, I was just wondering, when you bring in somebody new who has experience in the private sector, are you able to bring them at a higher salary so that you don't always have to take brand-new college graduates or can you actually bring in some people at higher levels that have some experience in the private sector?
Commissioner Selman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, good question. We have been struggling to be able to provide them a sufficient salary. First of all, we bring in a lot of relatively new younger folks with new accounting degrees, for example, and we are limited, at least we were severely limited before we entered into an MOU with the Department of Employee Relations, actually with the MAPE union, to give us a little more flexibility. But let me just read you some numbers. In the first year of employment, the Minnesota can provide up to $35,000 for an incoming accountant. And the incoming number may be not as critical as what we can do for them in the next year or two after they're on the job. That's where we begin to lose our competitiveness. Our turnover has been originally about the problem occurred after the first year, dramatic loss of employees, with about a third of people hired are gone within that were gone in that first year. Then we entered into a MOU with the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, with the blessings of the Department of Employee Relations, to get a little more flexibility to provide them more salary coming in, but more importantly, to have more flexibility to give them a bump after a year. And that's helped. It's moved the turnover from being a one-year issue to now maybe being a two-year. We're still evaluating that. I have a chart I'll be happy to provide the members that shows how the path of salaries over time, based on tenure, compares between Minnesota, the IRS, and the state of Iowa, Department of Revenue. And they'll give you a sense of what we're dealing with. I'll keep one for myself here. So we've had some relief with the memo of understanding. It is due to be renewed on June 30th, and we expect that that will be renewed. Mr. Chair, the slide that you're looking at now shows the age distribution of our employees. If you'll focus on the blue bars, which are 2006, the lighter ones are 2003, you can see we have a much older, higher numbers of employees in the 51-plus age group. You'll see the 41 to 50 at 307, the 31 to 40 at 147. We've been working hard with compliance initiatives to bring in people to the entry-level jobs. That's showing up now in the 202. What I think is most frightening about this chart are the people who are approaching retirement and the numbers relative to the people who are coming in behind them. And the fact that the 31 to 40 is the lowest bar. My concern is that we're starting to see a hollowing out of the middle of that distribution, age distribution. In a perfect world, you'd have maybe a more linear graph that showed or maybe a reverse, where you want to have people in the previous cohort group who are going to be ready to take over when people in the older cohort group retire. And it's disturbing to me that we have so few people in that 31 to 40 age group. I don't know how we fix that in the short run, but in the long run, we need to get more competitive and provide a more challenging and rewarding workforce, work environment. I mentioned the steep competition. I think I've made some of these points in the past. This is all, I think, an outgrowth of Sarbanes-Oxley and all the new financial reporting requirements at the federal level imposed by Congress. It created a high demand for accountants that's resulted in high turnover rates for our newly hired folks. But one out of every three newly hired accountants leave the agency in 1 to 3 years. I mentioned the memo of understanding. We expect that that will be renewed. It won't be the end all, and won't be the ultimate fix, but it will buy us some time, hopefully. And then the high turnover again regularly diverts senior level auditors to and supervisors from high yield audits to training. When you bring in new people, assuming you can get them at our entry salaries, you have to train them. And we don't have, you know, an academy of auditing within the department. We have to take senior-level auditors and have them take time away from high-yield audits to train the young folks coming in, or the new people coming in, to be more accurate. So there's, again, the potential loss of revenue from doing that. It's not ideal. And then, of course, when you do get them trained, you have to start all over again with the turnover that we have. So it's really frustrating. The agency is pursuing a number of strategies to attract and retain. I mentioned the MOU. We're trying to make salaries more competitive, especially at the entry level. We're trying to improve the reward and recognition programs. We're giving achievement awards wherever we can. We're trying to create a culture of recognition in the department, not just monetary rewards, but celebrating successes and, you know, having high visibility to those kinds of activities. Providing expanded learning and professional growth. We have a number of academies within the department. I mentioned we don't have an audit academy yet. Maybe we need one. But we are training people through what we call a leadership academy to be prepared for to take over some of these higher-level positions in the department. So we're spending a lot of time and money and effort on making sure people are getting training opportunities. And we're paying attention to life-work balance issues. You know, people have different needs nowadays for their work environment. We try to be very flexible, flex time, whatever we can do to make the work environment more acceptable and satisfying to them as part of a broader strategy of retaining employees.
Sarah Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Salamone. The folks that come, and these first-year people, are they using the Department of Revenue for their year of experience for their CPA license? And is that one of the reasons why they're leaving, that they get that and then they go on to greener pastures, or are they go out on their own as sole proprietors? How many of your new hires already have are fully qualified CPAs who have passed the exam and have had their all their other requirements to call themselves CPAs?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I'm told about a quarter of our new hires fit that description.
Which description? Which one?
Coming in with, I think you said a CPA, accounting degree.
They come in fully qualified, a quarter of them. They're not using the Department of Revenue for their year of experience for their license.
Mr. Chair,
how does that work?
Senator Rest, I don't think we can honestly say, I mean, we can't determine their motivation coming in. After the fact, it appears
I didn't mean, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Selman, I didn't mean that in a negative way. I just meant that their first year that they're there, they haven't worked for an accounting firm or anywhere else, and so their year at the Department of Revenue is their qualifying experience year.
Exactly.
For their license. How many do you have in that category?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I noted earlier that about a third, a couple years ago, about a third of our new hires would leave us after 1 year. So in effect, we are providing that training for them. I've heard stories, for example, of employees would be in their cubicles, and you could hear the recruiting call go from cubicle to cubicle from some outside recruiter. So the pressures are there for them to consider alternatives once they're on the job.
Sarah Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, Commissioner, and how many of them have passed a CPA exam before they come to work for the Department of Revenue?
It may have been a 25% you were talking about. About 25%.
And where did the other 75? What are the other 75% come from?
We have revenue tax collection positions.
And those are not CPAs.
And those are non-CPAs. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, okay. Commissioner, are they lawyers?
Some may be, but that typically they wouldn't be. You want to use the microphone?
Yeah. Why don't you come on?
Okay, so it's Dennis Erno, our Assistant Commissioner for Support, is saying they are basically coming to the department for training because they're coming without those credentials, many of them.
So, Mr. Chairman, as part of that training, is trying to find a way of retaining them rather than having them move on to open their own practice or...
That's right.
Because it's really good experience, obviously, to work for a Department of Revenue and then go and set up your own tax practice.
Absolutely.
And I suppose that happens at, I mean, it happens at any number of accounting firms, too, where you have to work under, as you know, a CPA for a period of time before you actually can have your license, even if you've passed your exam. And you just can't do that on your own.
Company time.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, what percentage of your employees, after they've been hired, then go and sit for the CPA exam?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I don't have that statistic. We might be able to get it for you. It would be an interesting one to have.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I think that would be really interesting to see just how many of them become CPAs, only on the experience level, but also are taking... I don't know what the requirement is now, but whether you have to pass every part of the exam at one point or whether it used to be that you, if you failed one part of the exam with a high fail, you didn't have to take the whole thing over again. You could just take that one part. But that would be interesting to me, too.
Senator Pappas?
Obviously, these workforce issues are very interesting to us as we're looking at in a lot of different areas, workforce shortages. So I just had a couple questions, too, not being as familiar with the qualifications. It sounds like you don't have to already be a CPA or a tax lawyer to become a tax auditor. You have people with a variety of background. So I'm kind of interested in what degrees usually people come to you with if it's not with a CPA. And also, have you thought about or are you doing anything with maybe post-retirement people. People who have taken early retirement were in a related field and might want to come back and work for you part-time, say. Or, you know, if people only stay with you for a year, you know, I know a lot of people who are 60 years old and say, no one will hire me because I'm too old. But yet they're, you know, they could have many more years of productivity left in them, especially if the young people are only staying a year or two.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, my name is Dennis Erno, Assistant Commissioner of Revenue. And for accounting positions in the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we do require an accounting degree. We will hire people who have a degree in financing or business administration, but the way our salary schedule works, we would pay a CPA entering or aging higher than we would somebody with accounting degree, and somebody with accounting degree higher than if they had a business administration degree. But we do only consider candidates right now that have an accounting or related degree. We do not pay people, accountants, to get their training for the CPA. We will not pay those fees. But for people that are accountants, we do offer continuing education courses that count towards their credits, which we think is a benefit, a great benefit to them. But the primary reason people come to us as an employer, they're coming to us, is they want to gain experience. And they realize that what is valuable is to build their resume and get that experience, and that experience means translates into higher compensation and officers. Our challenge is basically in the agency is to make it a rewarding place to work, address some of their life balance issues so we're more competitive on those, and because we'll never be entirely competitive on the salary. But the problem we face, not only the Department of Revenue, but all agencies face today, is our classification system is not market-based, nor is it sensitive to changes in the marketplace. It's basically based on hay points and difficulty. So there are some professions out there where we overpay, and there's other professions, such as accountings or in technology area or in the healthcare industry, where we can't be competitive on sale because it's not market-driven. One state, Idaho, has changed their classification system this year, so it's weighted 40% towards market conditions and then 60% towards hay positions. So some states are looking at other means of compensation systems to be more attractive to college graduates.
Sarah Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, would you need special legislation, for example, to permit bonuses? Say after someone's there for 5 years, they can get a $10,000 bonus, which some private businesses do. And also, another thing that I think is often a problem in attracting candidates is that you're pretty centrally located. And if people, not everybody wants to live, you know, close to St. Paul and have, I don't know, you know, as the department grows, would you consider dispersing around the state a little more? Could that work? Because then you'd have a potential new pool of workers that you could draw on that probably don't want to move here, but would be very good job applicants.
That's an issue that many of our outstate colleagues have raised many times, saying, you know, some of these jobs don't have to be done in St. Paul. Commissioner, Mr. Ruto?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the issue here is, you know, in terms of compensation, is agencies have limited funds. So the more we talk about basically bonuses to some, that means if we're going to pay those higher bonuses, then that means we're going to be hiring fewer people. So we always have that tension between the salaries we're paying and the total dollars we have available to pay them. The more and more dollars we pay for compensation, the less and less dollars we're going to have available to maintain our current workforce. So that's what we struggle with a lot. What I would suggest is, you know, all state agencies are basically going to have this problem, especially for a lot of high-demand positions, again, like in accountants, healthcare field. We need to put some mechanisms in place that help our salary schedules reflect more of what's happening in the marketplace. I don't think we have to pay the same as what's in the marketplace or as high, because I think we're more competitive on some other issues. The question came up earlier from Senator Rest, you know, do we get some more experienced employees? Yes, we do. We get employees that basically are middle-aged or towards the end of their careers that are basically burn out from their professions, and what's most important to them is really the life balance issues, you know, working 8 hours a day and having flex time and such.
Yeah. What about the out-state issue? We've had proposals in the past saying, well, we could have facilities up in Ely and do the same work up there and, you know, maybe get some people there, because not everybody wants to be in St. Paul. So do we need all the jobs down here, or what should we do?
The answer today about whether we need jobs down here is no. Basically, technology has made it possible to have jobs anywhere. But one thing we have to be cautious about is, especially when we're talking about auditors, they have to be near where the economic activity is, and to actually conduct the audits on site or on premises of the employer. So to some extent, we have to reflect, our workforce has to be aligned with where the economic activities are, where the businesses are located. That's why we have auditors in several states for a function such as collection, which is collecting delinquent taxes. That's more desk space, and that could be located anywhere. That could be located up in Ely. That can be located in Duluth. That can be located up in Bowabic, anywhere where they have the infrastructure available for us to do those phone calls.
Well, given the fact that we have businesses all over the state, do we have auditors all over the state, or do the auditors have to travel to the businesses, or the business travel to St. Paul? I mean, how does that work right now?
Mr. Chair, we do have offices in most of the regional areas, centers of the state. And we have a number of offices outside the state, New Jersey, Dallas-Fort Worth. So we think we have a pretty good distribution of offices. The one in Ely happens to sort of focus on collections, and the others are more have a broader range of things that they can do.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Go ahead.
Moving forward, the next challenge, diverse population. We need to provide expanded services beyond the specialized outreach programs we currently offer to populations with limited English speaking skills. I mentioned that earlier. We're looking at translating more of our materials into multiple languages. That's a pretty intensive effort. We're also looking to develop text instructions in languages other than English, including telephone assistance for limited English-speaking populations. So there's a lot going on in that area. I didn't bring with me the list of languages, but it's growing. This is an important area. Changes in the economy, you could go on and on about what's happening here. Globalization of the economy. Borders are increasingly meaningless in a global economy. Even concepts of physical presence on which we depend so much in the tax area. We like to, when we're determining whether something is taxable, we look at locations of things. For example, apportionment of corporate income is based on property, payroll, and sales. What percentage of those three things are in Minnesota versus outside of Minnesota? It becomes increasingly difficult to administer a tax system where most of the concepts are based on physical location. And increasingly, it's difficult to identify where the location actually is. Companies can exist without a physical location, and so it's a real increasing challenge for us. Electronic commerce is another whole set of issues dealing with purchases over the Internet and the digitization of what used to be physical products into digital products, for example, audio or video, audio books. I mention that because our sales tax, for example, is primarily a tax on tangible goods. And how do you deal with things that have been converted from tangible format to a digital format? Now, we're working on these issues. I have to mention, of course, the Streamlined Sales Tax Project. All of you, I think, are familiar with that.
I'm not sure everybody is. Maybe
okay.
You can just briefly describe what that is.
It's a multi-state effort that began, I believe, in 2000 after a court case known as the Quill case, a U.S. Supreme Court case, ruled that a state could not enforce its sales tax laws on companies that did not have a physical presence in the state. So any company, a catalog sales company or an Internet vendor selling into Minnesota with no physical presence here could not be, according to that court case, could not be required to enforce Minnesota sales tax laws. As you know, we depend on the retailers to collect and remit sales tax. Not an issue for companies that have a physical presence here, but it's a real problem for companies that don't. Recognizing the limits of that court case, states got together and thought it would be a good idea to try to overcome Quill by having more common sales tax laws, definitions, and fewer rates. The objection of Quill primarily was an interstate commerce issue, that the divergence of definitions and the number of tax rates for over 7,000 jurisdictions nationally was considered to be an obstacle to interstate commerce. So states have been working hard since 2000 to try to get common definitions to products and services and to reduce the number of rates and to have common registration for sales tax permits, common processes for dispute resolution, and so on. That project is beginning to mature. We have now about 16 states that have gotten common definitions. They're considered fully conformed to the Streamlined Sales Tax Project definitions. There's another six states that are so-called associate members. So we're getting a critical mass of states that have common sales taxes. And the hope is that perhaps we'll get, hopefully this year, some legislation federally to overcome the Quill court decision. So We're hoping that this is the year where we actually can get a streamlined sales tax bill, which would empower states to collect sales tax on internet sales, on catalog sales, so-called remote sales, even if they don't have a physical presence in the state. Whether that legislation comes or not is anyone's guess, but I think the climate is better for it in Washington. The things I'm reading are very optimistic that we're going to get federal legislation that will give states the authority to collect internet sales and other remote sales taxes.
Do we have any estimate what that would mean as far as income to the state if we can get something like that going?
Trying to remember that number. There are estimates out there. I'm guessing for Minnesota it might be in the neighborhood of $150 million or so. In fact, in the current forecast, we have booked some money for streamlined sales tax revenue. I think it's about $35 million. It's already in the forecast.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go on.
I mentioned the shift from tangible goods to electronic goods, but there's also a shift primarily driven by the aging population of purchases, sales taxable purchases from tangible goods, which are largely taxable, to services. As people get older, they tend to buy fewer things and buy more services, particularly health services. We don't tax services for the most part. We have a short list of things that we put in statute, I believe, in 1987, maybe added a few along the way, dog groomers and window washing. But if you look at a study I alluded to earlier called the Tax Expenditure Study, there's a page in that report, it's a department report, that shows the amount of revenues that are currently not collected as a result of not taxing services. And it's quite a large number. But it's just the nature of our sales tax. Like most states, it's an industrial era kind of tax, and we really didn't think a lot about services back in the other states in the 30s and in Minnesota in 1967 when we enacted the sales tax. So I think we're a little bit out of step with the economy there long term. And then, of course, another aspect of aging population is the fact that seniors have less taxable income. If you look at the share of their gross income that's taxable, and compare seniors to non-seniors, you can see as much as a 40% difference in that share. And that's a little bit, 40 percentage point difference between people over 65 and under 65. And that will eventually show up in the form of reduced income tax revenues as the system sort of ages. So that's another sort of long-term issue that we flag. Finally, growing complexity of tax laws. I mentioned that if left alone, tax systems tend to get more complicated over time due to the addition of credits and exemptions and federal changes in definitions. You all did a nice thing earlier this session by passing federal conformity, and that will greatly simplify what would have been a very complicated tax return this year. We have to be vigilant on a year-to-year basis to try to stay conform to the federal definitions, a federal taxable income, for example. That's our starting point. But obviously, there's always political decisions that need to be made about whether a particular change is something we want to follow or not follow. I don't think anyone would say we should blindly follow the feds. There are a few states that do that by statute, but we don't. In 87, actually in 86, the federal government did massive income tax reform. Minnesota took advantage of that by piggybacking on the new definition of federal taxable income starting in 87. Back in 87, we had a one-page income tax form and a half-a-page short form. I wish I could have brought those along. When I say one page, I mean one side of one page in 87. That's not the case today. Over time, things have gotten more complicated. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad. There may have been good policy reasons for a lot of those changes. In the sales tax in 1995, we had 88 tax expenditures. These are exemptions or credits or other preferential items in the sales tax. In 2006, we have 153. And if you're curious about what those are, you can go to that tax expenditure study.
Exemptions. I mean.
Exemptions, credits.
No, you said expenditures. You mean exemptions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tax expenditure study.
Okay. Gotcha.
We call them tax expenditures because the concept is that you're really providing something to taxpayers that could, in some cases, just be also provided via an appropriation. They're no different analytically. So there is that catalog of all those expenditures, tax expenditures that you can. I hope you have, but if you don't, we can get you copies. More complexity, why does this matter? More complexity increases the need for more taxpayer assistance, certainly in the income tax. It also means more difficult and time-consuming audits. So complexity is never good for anyone, maybe except the practitioners if there is an exception. But it's just not a good thing to have a system get increasingly complicated. And then finally, improving the tax compliance compliance with the tax laws. It's really a big task. It means better data and technology, and I'll stress technology, simpler tax laws, better taxpayer service, improved enforcement tools, and a coordinated federal-state relationship. We're doing more and more with the feds, sharing more data, and that's going to help with compliance. Here's a picture of our base budget before the governor's recommendations for fiscal year 08-09. I don't think there's much to say here other than 94% of our money is general fund money of the $220 million, roughly $221 million. This is a slide we will look at again after we talk about the change items very quickly. There are four change items. The first one is modernization of our computer systems, sounding like a broken record here. Second, the other three are not necessarily in priority order, but there is a proposal that the governor has for expanding tax auditing enforcement activities. That is another compliance initiative. There's a proposal, I think statewide, for a compensation adjustment of 2% for the state employees. And the creation of, our fourth one is the creation of a property tax information and data exchange system. Our property tax division is on the cusp of putting together some really helpful ways to exchange data with the counties, for example, electronic certificates of real estate paid and other kind of property tax data.
Just a question. Those were the ones that the governor proposed. Were there any areas that the department felt they needed that the governor did not support and did not include in the budget?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any. We were quite pleased to get these four, and I don't know that we had any others that we were pushing.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm just wondering, back on the base budget, it says that there's a highway user's tax that you receive $4.1 million in revenue from in a biennium, or you're projected to. And I'm trying to figure out what that is.
The department administers the gas tax, and I think that's what we're talking about here. And that goes to a special fund, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. So that's our little piece of that. There are other funds that go into that highway fund.
So this is a pass-through from the pump through the Department of Revenue to the Department of Transportation?
Yes.
So, okay.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Let me give you a little more then on the governor's change item. The first one, the integrated tax system, will consolidate all these functions we were talking about into one single system, better integration of data. I don't know that I need to go through all the details here. For all 28 tax types, we would have a common process for business registration and taxpayer identification, a common process for tax return and payment processing, common accounting processes, common auditing processes. I can't stress the value of that commonality, common delinquent tax collection and reporting functions. The advantages, you can read for yourself here, I'll just pick out a few of the same functionality for all types, improved quality of services to the taxpayer, the comprehensive data for business decision making, effectiveness of tax compliance activities. We will actually, down the road after implementation, probably have a positive compliance increase as a result of this integrated tax system. It would lessen the risk of obsolete system failure, which we worry a lot about. It mitigates the high cost of maintaining legacy systems. We will spend $7 to $9 million in the next 3 years upgrading that patchwork of systems I had up on the screen earlier. And what we'll get for it is a reduction in the risk of failure, no new functionality, no new efficiency. So if we're going to spend that kind of money, it seems silly not to spend what we think is needed for an integrated tax system. And we clearly will get, as I mentioned, increased revenues down the road and operational efficiency. I mentioned the states that have recently adopted an integrated system. There's a growing list. I'm sure this list is probably a little out of date. In fact, I think there's a province of Canada that has recently gone this way. Some states are reporting revenue increases post-implementation, so we know it's the right thing to do. The funding for this, I want to be real clear, we are anticipating a commercial off-the-shelf product. We anticipate competitive bidding, and we're working on an RFP as we speak, so we want to get off the block as soon as we get approval. The total cost is $38 million over a four-year period, but we will be able to redirect $11 million from existing Revenue Department technology funds. That's part of the $7 to $9 million I just mentioned is part of that. There's some other related items that we can add to it for a total of an $11 million offset with existing funds, leaving a $28 million four-year appropriation that we need approval for. $16 million of that will be in the current, I shouldn't say the current, the next budget, the 08-09, $12 million of which would be in the 10-11 biennium. The second item is a tax compliance initiative. The governor is recommending that we be appropriated $10.2 million, for which we will return gross revenues of 51.2 from an increased compliance for a net gain of 40, I believe, $40.1 million, or roughly $40 million. We have, as you know, a fairly successful history of tax compliance initiatives, so we are fairly confident that we will be able to raise the $51 million and return $40 million to the general fund. We're in the midst right now of attracting the next change item is the compensation adjustment. I think for the department, this amounts to about $5.2 million. We are working hard to attract new employees and to keep them in a competitive market and to retain newly hired employees as well as experienced ones. It's really important to us as a department to have the 2% compensation adjustment enacted. It's a good chance to put in a plug for that. Finally, there's a relatively small change item, $980,000 a year, $900 even per year, to allow our property tax division, which has been working very closely with the counties, who are very supportive of all of this activity, to bring more technology to the exchange of information with the counties. We're at the point in the development of this where we are beginning to ask for counties to volunteer to be early adopters of this new technology, pilot, if you will. But it will focus on having electronic certificate of real estate value from the counties in modernizing the system for issuing deeds of transfer and for tax forfeited lands and enhancing various other data and information transactions of the county, a critical piece of modernization. With those items, it's about $33 million of change items that brings our total budget from all funds up to $254 million. And you can see the distribution is roughly the same as it was before, but we're still primarily a general fund agency at 95%. And I believe that's the end of the presentation, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I saw the commissioner in here, too. I don't know if he wants to. Did you want to tell us anything, too, Commissioner?
No.
Okay. I do have just kind of an unrelated question. You know, we built the Revenue Building a few years ago, and now we've got the Anderson Building across the freeway, and we've got the Freeman Building over here. We've got all these employees coming in here. Where do they park? I mean, what do they do? You know, I mean, it's tough enough for when we're in town here, but some of these employees have to come here year-round, and I don't know where they go.
Mr. Chair, that is an issue that the Department of Administration has been looking to address. I know they have a proposal to buy the church property, which is right near our building, that would provide, I think, an additional 90 spaces of parking. Parking is tight. We have a lot of employees who park up on the hill and walk down.
Yeah.
Some of us who come to work after 8:30 or so wind up parking on the roof of our building, and that's a real cost to pay for coming in a little later than because it's a very tedious building to drive through from roof to first floor. It is a problem. There's no question about it, and I don't know all the strategies that admin is looking at, but I know one of them is to buy that building and convert it to parking.
Well, 90 spaces helps, but boy, we sure have a lot of people around here, and I don't know how far that's going to go. So, any other questions for the department? Senator Olsen.
When you were here last time, I believe we talked a little bit about off-the-books accounting on construction and how a lot of construction – well, somebody was here. but for there's an effort, I think, particularly by the unions to work on going after contractors that, you know, they don't turn any paperwork in on their employees. And, you know, so it's really an off-the-books accounting on a lot of construction projects. Not that you guys are doing anything off the books, but is some of these proposals you're talking about, would that go after some of, be able to go after some of those revenues, do you believe?
Yes, I do believe that. I'm not sure where we're at in the department in terms of what we currently are able to do now with sort of the cash economy. I think maybe that's one way to describe what you're talking about. It's a problem. We had some legislation, I believe, last year to deal with contractors. So we flag these issues for the legislature. Sometimes we get what we want, sometimes we don't. It is one of those, it's part of that tax gap I was talking about earlier, is a sort of unreported income. And when you don't have supporting documents, we all have the experience of a contractor or some sort of builder coming to our properties and saying, oh, I'd like to be paid in cash. And that's a red flag. And you have to resist saying, well, I work for the revenue department. It's always a surprise when they hear that. But that is an issue for us, one of several in that area.
Sir Olsen, anything?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Deputy Commissioner, one of my other questions in your presentation, you had listed a number of these other states that had this integrated tax system. Do you have an idea of, you know, I know there's various population states there, but how about how much it costs those states to implement those programs?
We do. We have a lot of data on that. We've visited most of these states. It varies quite a bit. Our requested appropriation is on the low end. We think it's doable, and there are a number of states that have done what we are asking to do in the price range that we expect to get. Some of the states that have much higher numbers, and I wish we had the chart handy, maybe Greg can share. Some of those who have paid more have been doing it under the higher cost has resulted from the fact that they didn't appropriate, they didn't have an appropriation, so they entered into an agreement with the vendors for what's called benefits funding. And vendors then take the risk of providing the software and installing it for which they expect a return, a percentage of new revenues from the state as a result of that project. And those tend to be very expensive because they're going to cover their risk by getting a high percentage of the additional revenue. I don't know if Minnesota would have an appetite for that. We assumed it wouldn't. The Finance Department historically has not viewed those sort of arrangements favorably. So we did, I think, the right thing to just come in with a straight request for an appropriation. I can read you numbers with this if it's helpful. I have Indiana came in at $16 million. Now, the vendors vary here, and I won't mention vendor names. Arizona, $122 million, Nevada, $28 million, Virginia.
Did you say 122?
122 in Arizona. That's benefits funded. Nevada, $28 million. That involved 17 tax types over 3 years. No income tax in that state, so there's that issue. Virginia, $168 million. Benefits funded over 7 years. A very broad implementation, including scanning, self-service, warehouse, data warehouse, and other things. So there's maybe not an apples to apples there. State of Kansas, $70 million benefits funded. Hawaii, $100 million benefits funded. Utah, $34 million. No indication of whether, I assume that's not benefits funded. Wisconsin started out at $38 million with one vendor and wound up switching to another. So they're at 38 and counting. There's apparently more to come here. Montana, 15 plus million. Idaho, 15 million. Louisiana, 14 plus. Florida, 61 million. So you'd have to get into the details to try to understand the variation, but one big one is that benefits funding explains the really big numbers.
Other questions? Sarah Roebling.
Thank you. I just have a question. Today we passed a bill about eliminating the scalping law. And I'm wondering, one of the things I said that it may bring in more sales tax revenue, I'm wondering if there could be a plan developed or if your department has thought about how that could occur. So, and then I'm wondering, once that ticket has been purchased and sales tax has been paid on it once, if someone else purchases it at a higher price, do they pay the sales tax for the whole new price again, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we have in our sales tax law a sale for resale exemption. I suppose if one bought it from a non-scalper to the original source and then resold it as a scalp ticket, if it were a legitimate transaction, we might be inclined to say that there was a sale for resale exemption that would apply. That is, we don't tax it a second time if it's bought with the idea that it was going to be resold. But because it's scalping, and I'm not sure what the law did that you passed today, whether it makes it illegal or not. But
It just repealed the current law that prohibits scalping. So presumably if
I see.
You got some Green Bay Packer fans out there and they want to buy some tickets and you want to sell it for double the price on the face, you can do that legally with this, and money will change hands and there's nobody there to, you know, count the number of bills that changed hands. So
it gets back to the conversation we just had. It'll be the off-book, unidentifiable transaction for the most part, unless we have a law that requires scalpers to come forward and volunteer that information.
It didn't do that. It just repealed the current scalping law, so anti-scalping law. So, I've got a question or two. Right at the end, you talked about the governor's recommendation, I think, for about $1.8 million for a statewide electronic certificate system. And we did increase the fees about 2 years ago so counties could have more money to go into that project. Do you have any idea what the counties are doing since we increased that fee, and how does this tie into their fee increase? Because, you know, again, we try to go in that direction, and I'm just not quite, you know, I want to make sure that these are consistent.
The fee you're speaking of is a county recorder fee.
Right, yeah.
And it was increased.
So they could go into this direction, yeah.
Right. It was increased in 2005 to, I think, from a situation where counties could set that themselves, and it varied all over the place. It was increased to $46 for every county. Mm-hmm. And of the 46, I think $10.50 was dedicated to the state, with the understanding that and the rest was local. And it was understood that the local portion would be largely used to upgrade technology.
Right.
And that's, I think, where we're at today. This proposal is not a request to dedicate any portion of the existing recorder fee. We thought about that initially, but as it morphed through the process, it turned out to be a straight-up appropriation of $900,000 a year for essentially to get the technology up and running and get all the counties on board.
So is this in addition to what we're doing with the counties, or have they been not be able to do it with the fee increases that we had then?
Believe it leaves the existing fees untouched.
Okay.
And simply, and we can verify that.
Okay, so they're raising money at the recording end for technology, and then we want some money here for technology too. So
Mr. Chair, they will have some expenses related to what they have to do. Yeah, we never did receive, as a department, any portion of that $10.50.
No, but they got it, though, so
right.
I'm just trying to figure out
where potentially an issue there.
Where the money's going.
We can check that out.
Okay. We're going to have the Office of Enterprise Technology in later this week, on Wednesday. It's my understanding that you've had some pilot project with them on some data management or some data issues, and how is that going, and are there any savings that resulted from it?
Mr. Chair, my first meeting with Gopal Khanna, the state CIO, was very cordial, but he came in and was very anxious to start doing what he was hired to do, and that was to sort of aggregate state systems and get some economies of scale. we soon saw the wisdom dealing with him to give him our data center in the department. And as of this moment, the Office of Enterprise Technology runs our data center. We transferred to them the positions that we had, and we had to negotiate which ones really were related to the data center versus other technology functions like support and the help desk and so on. We did provide them, I believe, about $5 million worth of hardware and about 10.5 FTEs associated with that data center. So that has gotten them off to a pretty good start in getting other agencies to provide that kind of to offload some of their systems responsibility. I want to mention that we did that with the understanding that we would have a very well-defined service-level agreement, that Gopal has been very clear that they would want to provide, they're promising the same level of service at a same or lower cost. So we, in a sense, kind of outsourced our data center to the Office of Enterprise Technology, and we wrote a very, very lengthy service-level agreement with them on which we will base our judgment of how well they're doing. And if it doesn't turn out, we feel we have the right to bring it back in-house or find another vendor. So I think it's a good model. It's working well so far. I don't know what else
are you saying the jury's still out, though? You haven't figured out whether you've got the savings or...
I think that's true. I think we're waiting to see because we've had some difficult transition issues in moving from the way we were structured to the way they're structured. They didn't have an appropriation to pay for things, and so we've had to sort of front a little money to make things happen. So I think it's accurate to say it'll be a while before we know how successful this is, but I'm confident that they're going to do a good job for us, and we are comforted by the service-level agreement that we've written with them.
When you say it might be a while, do you have any benchmarks that you can point to what you're looking at?
3 to 4 years.
3 to 4 years, okay.
Mr. Chair, I might add also, you reminded me when you mentioned OET, the integrated tax system is among their top priorities. We've vetted it through that process. It is on their top tier of priority projects, what they consider a potentially enterprise-level application. It also, I think, enjoys the support of the finance department. So I think we've covered all of our bases and hope we can make some progress in that this year.
Okay. Any other questions for the Department of Revenue? If not, okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, and thank you for Commissioner. Wednesday, we will have the Office of Enterprise Technology, and again, they were in earlier this session. Now, you've heard a lot of requests from the various agencies. They want some computers, and there's going to be a ton of money asked for computers. And so I guess we've got to ask a lot of questions to make sure that we just don't spend lots of money in for systems that may not be compatible or work or whatever. So there's a lot of interest in this area. So think about that between now and then. So anything else before us? Okay, if not, then thank you, and the meeting's adjourned.